This is Jim Inkster, and welcome to the Thanksgiving Day edition of Talk Louisiana. And we start with a gentleman who's not only an expert on the Kennedy assassination, which has relevance today. It was November 22, 1963, that the 35th American president, John Kennedy, was killed in Dallas. But Joseph McBride is also an authority on Orson Welles. He knew the man, and he's written about Orson Welles prolifically, and is the author of the definitive biography about the great filmmaker who made Citizen Kane. And let's start there, Joseph McBride, before we get to JFK. You have been involved, let's say, with two giants, one in the entertainment industry and one that you've gotten to know posthumously, perhaps America's most revered president.
Yeah, well, I actually worked for Kennedy as a volunteer in his 1960 Wisconsin presidential primary campaign. And my mother was active in Democratic politics when I was 12, and she got me in there as a volunteer. So I met him three times, twice during the campaign, once when he was president.
Well, he was 43 years old then. I'm sure he was a man of immense magnetism.
Oh, he was very, very exciting. For a young person, it was a breath of fresh air. I didn't quite appreciate that Eisenhower was actually a pretty good president. But Kennedy, you know, I mean, I liked the fact that he was very eloquent and he talked fast. I liked that. Huh. Eisenhower seemed very slow and befuddled at the time, and it wasn't at his prime. But Kennedy's vision and his idealism and forward thinking and charisma, great speaking, all that really excited a young guy. And I wanted to go into politics, but when he was killed, I lost my faith in the system and decided to become a writer instead.
Well, let's start with your association with Orson Welles, who is, along with Warren Beatty, the only actor to ever have been nominated in the same year for Best Actor, Best Director, Best Writer, and Best Producer. It was for Citizen Kane, but he did much more than that, as we know, and he had an immense life of 70 years and died in 1985, and here we are 33 years later, yeah. And there's a film starring Orson Welles. How did this happen?
Well, yeah, it's amazing, isn't it? It's a miracle kind of that this film, The Other Side of the Wind, gets finished, and I've been involved with it since 1970 when he put me in the film the first day of shooting, and then I kept coming back for five more years intermittently. I play a young film historian, film critic who's following John Huston around. He plays a legendary old director who's trying to make a comeback in the new Hollywood, what we now call the easy rider era, when the studios were collapsing and the young people were taking over. And so I'm a comical figure, more or less, asking him a lot of kind of funny, pretentious film buff questions and irritating him throughout the film. And it was a kind of a Walter Mitty experience for me to be in this film with all these amazing actors and to be directed by the person I think is the greatest actor's director in cinema. And I was a non-actor, which was very, very bizarre for me. And for many years, the film was held up legally and financially and even politically. There are all kinds of problems. It's just kind of, Huston said it was the most desperate situation a film could ever get in. And I tried in the 90s to find a backer to get the film out, and for a while we had Showtime interested, but that didn't come off. And finally, Frank Marshall, and who just won the Thalberg Award with his wife, Kathleen Kennedy, and Philip Jan Rimsa and Peter Bogdanovich produced it, and Netflix put up the money, and which is fantastic, and they gave them complete creative control and didn't interfere with them. And they put together, it was over 1,000 cans of film. Bob Murawski did a fantastic job editing the film in the style that Welles wanted, and he set the style by editing 42 minutes of it. But it's quite an amazing job of retrieval, and the footage was in great shape. It was in a lab in Paris for all those years, but putting it together was a Herculean job. There's a documentary on Netflix called A Final Cut for Orson, 40 Years in the Making, which I recommend. It's really a fascinating study of how they did that.
And you say it's a surprisingly good film.
Yeah, it's better even than I expected, and I always had faith that the film would work. There were people who were skeptical, and I mean, I didn't know everything because, you know, when I saw the film, I'm a consultant on the film as well as an actor, and in January, I and the other consultant, Jonathan Rosenbaum, went to Santa Monica to look at an intermediate cut and offer suggestions, and it really knocked me out because there were a lot of scenes I hadn't seen. I had seen a kind of a rough assembly that was put together, but when you see all the terrific performances put together, for example, it is very impressive, and also to see it in the beautiful color and black and white photography, cleaned up and really terrific, and the sound was wonderfully put together. They really had the top flight people working on it. Scott Millan did the sound. He's won 4 Academy Awards, and we had to reconstruct some of the dialogue because some of the sound recording was not terribly good because of wind noise and things like that. So I recorded, re-recorded 17 of my lines, which was a surreal experience after 48 years to be doing my part again.
When was the last scene of the Other Side of the Wind shot?
Early 76. We did a lot of shooting in Arizona in 74, and then 75 at Peter Bogdanovich's house in Bel Air. He was off in Europe doing Daisy Miller, and Wells took over his house, and we did a lot of shooting, and I was working at Variety, and I would go there at night after work and do more scenes, and we kept going till early 76, and then it sat there. Wells tried to edit the film, but it's a brilliant film. It's very experimental. It's two different kinds of films put together. It's a framing story of a party that's shot in sort of mockumentary style, cinema verite style. Wells is kind of spoofing, where the cameras. The conceit is that there are a lot of different cameras at the party, and they're all filming this. And so it's Wells deliberately looked for a kind of a rough, shaky cam look, but it's very wonderfully put together and edited. And then there's a film within the film that's shot in 35 millimeter color, which is very lavish looking. But kind of a spoof of artsy European filmmaking, or the kind of films that some of the young directors were making in Hollywood around that time that were kind of incomprehensible. So it's a very complex mixture of things and a lot of different characters intersecting, and a lot of themes, sexual themes and other themes that are strung through the film. A very complex story, and it all hangs together beautifully, and a lot of people are just dazzled by the film. I'm very pleased at the general reception it has.
Three books have been written by our guest Joseph McBride about Orson Welles. The last, Whatever Happened to Orson Welles? And this man who died in 1985 was 70 years old, and he directed, co-wrote, and starred in Citizen Kane, widely regarded by many as the greatest film ever, when he was all of, 25 years old.
Yeah.
So some people view his career as a disappointment. How do you view it?
Yeah, I see it very differently. I think it was a tremendous triumph, frankly. For example, they're billing this as the final film by Orson Welles, which is not true. He, as I say, he finished shooting in 76, and then he kept shooting films for 9 years after that. He was always making films. He was working outside the system, so a lot of people didn't even know he was working. And they just saw him doing TV commercials and things like that, and they thought, well, it's sad, he's had a come down. But he was making these experimental, very daring films, often at his home with his own money. And he would use his money that he made from commercials and acting to fund these films, which is something that, it's kind of a taboo in the film industry to put your own money into films. And he was, I see him as an independent filmmaker, the kind of prototype of that. And he was working briefly for the major studios with Citizen Kane and The Magnificent Ambersons, which is another great film. And I just participated in the Blu-ray edition that's just coming out. And but then he was expelled from the studios because he was, he was an art house director, not a commercial director. That was his problem. And he was actually a very efficient filmmaker, but they actually lied about the reasons they fired him from a documentary he was making in South America. They said he was over budget, but he was actually more than $400,000 under budget, I found in going through the documents. So that was the basic lie that hurt his career. And he was driven to Europe. Eventually, he was blacklisted, and he was very progressive politically, and he started making films in Europe like Othello with his own money that took 4 years to shoot, and he developed a different kind of style, which is more fragmented and based on editing more than long takes and elaborate camera movements, which you couldn't do working independently. He had to do that, you know, he could do that in the studios. And when he went back to Hollywood to do Touch of Evil, which is a great film, he had these lavish resources and did some amazing long takes. And the studio was horrified, though, at the darkness of the film and took it away from him. And that really was, he was fed up with the studio system at that point and didn't want to work with them again.
We're visiting with Joseph McBride, a Renaissance man, film historian, biographer, screenwriter, and author and educator. And we'll return after this time out with more Talk Louisiana. This is Jim Inkster, and thank you for joining us on Thanksgiving Day for Talk Louisiana. We continue our discussion with Joseph McBride, who is an authority on the life of Orson Welles. And there is a new film that was filmed between 1970 and 76, The Other Side of the Wind, that Orson Welles had in the can when he died in 1985. It is out and about, and before we part company with Joseph McBride, we have to talk with him about what happened on this day 55 years ago in 1963, November 22nd. John Kennedy, all of 46 years old, was assassinated in Dealey Plaza, Dallas. He, like Orson Welles, was a giant in his realm. Orson Welles, born in May of 1915, John Kennedy in May of 1917. And there is still great mystery, as you know, Joseph McBride, about what happened in Dallas on that day. And before we get to what you think happened, do you think we'll ever really know?
Well, I think we know an awful lot. I was friendly with Penn Jones, Jr., who was a small-town Texas newspaper editor who was covering the story from the first day. And I said to him when I met him in the 80s doing research, I said, do you think, you know, we'll ever solve the case? He said, well, I think I and a few friends solved it basically in the 1960s, and I think he was pretty right. A lot of details have been filled in. It's an amazingly complex case, and there are things we may never know, but I think we know the broad outlines, and we know an awful lot of details through documents and interviews. A lot of witnesses have come forward very bravely. To me, those are the real heroes of the case, the citizens who've come forward to tell the truth about what they saw that contradicts the official theory that one man did it alone, which is doesn't hold up. And also the murder of Officer J.D. Tippit the same day. Both were blamed on Lee Harvey Oswald, but the evidence falls apart if you really examine it. And I spent 31 years researching the case for my book, Into the Nightmare, My Search for the Killers of President John F. Kennedy and Officer J.D. Tippit, which came out in 2013, but I keep researching the case. I'm still working on it and always will. But more documents are still remaining to come out. The government was going to release all of them, and Trump said he was going to do that last year, and then he was pressured by the CIA and the FBI to withhold certain documents, which is strange. If one man did it alone, some crazy guy without a motive, how come they're withholding, you know, a couple thousand documents even today?
Well, Donald Trump, as we know, has bucked his intelligence agencies many times. Why would he capitulate on this?
That's a good question. Yeah, he's, you know, right now he's going against the CIA finding that the Saudis killed the journalist Khashoggi. But I think that there are so many dark secrets in there I think it's indisputable at this point that our government was involved in killing President Kennedy, elements of the government. It was a military takeover, in effect. And President Johnson, for a long time, I resisted the idea that Johnson could have been involved, but I think now it's obvious. And, for example, the autopsy was faked. They did a reconstruction of Kennedy damaging his head before the official autopsy, and there are actually witnesses to this, that they removed part of his skull and the bullet in his right temple and things like that, to cover up what really happened. And that was a military autopsy. It was the U.S. Navy. And then Johnson appointed the Warren Commission to cover it up, and J. Edgar Hoover, running the FBI, was very anti-Kennedy, and he concluded within 2 hours that the case was closed, which is crazy. I mean, if you had a legitimate investigation, you could not figure out a case of that magnitude that fast. So all the evidence is that our government did a terrible job in investigating the crime, and you have to ask yourself what they're hiding. There are certain elements of the government who were being protected. And when I found that out, when I realized that in the 60s, it really disillusioned me that our government would do that, to have a president who was, you know, had his brains blown out on a public street at high noon, and they didn't solve the case.
There is a gentleman who lives right here in our community of Baton Rouge, Richard Lipsey, who was the guard attached to President Kennedy in Washington, and he was in the room when the autopsy was conducted, and he insists rather fervently that everything was on the up and up, there was nothing unusual, and he shares the late Vincent Bugliosi's theory that this is something that has been a cottage industry that has run amok, and that Lee Harvey Oswald did it alone, and that everything points to Oswald. How do you answer those who believe that so passionately and without any horse in the race? They're certainly not trying to cover up anything, or they weren't part of any kind of conspiracy, but they believe this.
Well, certain people, you know, were in the autopsy room who didn't know the whole story. I mean, there was, as I mentioned, a pre-autopsy. Dr. James Humes, Commander Humes, was the autopsist who did this clandestine surgery. Douglas Horn, who was on the Assassination Records Review Board, wrote a 5-volume work on this, and he found witnesses who saw this removal of metal from Kennedy's head and parts of his head. And I found an FBI document that I think destroys the entire case back in the 80s that on the night of November 22nd, the number two man at the FBI wrote a memo and said, there's a bullet lodged behind the president's right ear, and we are in the process of obtaining that. And that was never admitted into evidence, but Secret Service men and other witnesses saw a bullet strike him in the right temple, and that's what blew the brains out the back of his head. And all the nurses and doctors at Parkland Hospital said there was a large hole the size of a fist in the back of his head, and there was no big hole at the top of his head, as we're now told. And so the body was changed. Everybody at Bethesda, well, not everybody, but most of the people at Bethesda saw things differently from what was seen in Dallas. And so you have to look at the earliest evidence, and those doctors and nurses are very good witnesses. But in terms of Oswald, what's really key is the ballistic evidence. And in the Tippit murder, the ballistic evidence doesn't hold up at all. The shells and the bullets do not match, and they don't match the alleged gun that Oswald supposedly had. This was an FBI expert who testified to that. And in the Kennedy shooting, the first gun they found was a Mauser, and then they later claimed it was a Mannlicher Carcano. And there was no real evidence linking Oswald to the gun. It's been proven that he didn't own a gun, either a pistol or a rifle.
I thought he bought that through a mail order process.
Well, that's what we were told, but there's a book by John Armstrong that really a tremendous job of research, and he traces all the supposed records that they had linking him to the gun, and there are all kinds of problems with the chain of evidence, even if you believe it was that gun.
Didn't he pose with a gun at one point?
Well, that picture has been called into question. That was on the cover of Life magazine, and to me it's an obvious fake. If you look at the picture, it looks like a composite of a body with somebody else's head. You can even see this horizontal line across the neck where they join them, and the shadows don't match, and he's holding a rifle and some left-wing documents, some newspapers, and it's obviously opposed. In the Dallas police files, there are some photographs that show a preliminary stage where they were posing a detective in the backyard, and then they put the body, parts of the body and the head onto Oswald. He said that himself when he was shown that picture, and he had worked in a photo lab, and he said, given enough time, I can prove to you this is a fake. And so there are a lot of pieces of evidence, so-called. He referred to it as the so-called evidence. He told that to his brother, that don't hold up. And so you have to be very skeptical about every piece of evidence and every statement. I found that very instructive as a researcher, that you can't take anything at face value, and that helped me as a researcher in other projects too, that just because somebody says something or it's printed or they have a photograph or a document, it doesn't mean it's true.
We're visiting with Joseph McBride. In 2013, he published Into the Nightmare, My Search for the Killers of President John F. Kennedy and Officer J.D. Tippit. And we'll spend one more segment with Joseph McBride after this brief pause on Talk Louisiana. Now the news. This is Jim Inkster, and we're pleased you're spending time with us on Thanksgiving Day. Hope you're having a great holiday, and we're closing it out with Joseph McBride in this segment. He is a man who has spent almost four decades researching the Kennedy assassination. He met him in 1960 when John Fitzgerald Kennedy was running for president. Joseph McBride was a young man in Wisconsin, and John Kennedy was a 43-year-old bright young U.S. senator, war hero, Pulitzer Prize winner, and he ended up winning the presidency, as we know, and in 1963, on this date, 55 years ago, at the age of 46, the 35th American president was killed in Dallas. That we know. We have what amounts to proof, and the Zapruder film has shown definitively that Kennedy was brutally shot in the head, but there are all kinds of questions remaining about where the shot came from. Were there multiple shots? Were there multiple gunmen? And without that film, Joseph McBride, would we have closed this case a long time ago?
Well, that's a good question. It certainly helped raise all kinds of questions. But when you study the Zapruder film, I mean, one of the things that you find out in this case is that certain stories that seem very kind of hard to believe turn out to be true. And the Zapruder film was faked. It was altered that weekend. The CIA had a secret laboratory in Rochester, New York. And Douglas Horn's extensive study found two CIA photo analysts who that weekend worked on two different versions of the film. They were preparing sort of billboard-type things that had frame enlargements on them, and they were two different films. And they took out certain things, like the car stopped. There are a lot of witnesses, including Senator Ralph Yarborough, who I interviewed, talked about the car stopping and Secret Service men swarming around the car. You don't see that in the Zapruder film. And also the nature of the wounds. They put a black mat over the back of Kennedy's head. I'm in a film that's being made called Alteration that I've seen the evidence. And special effects people in Hollywood, when they look at that stuff, say it's a rather crude forgery. So that film, it does show Kennedy thrown violently backward, and that they couldn't change that. And when the public finally saw that in 1975, after it was put on television, that's when the public wanted another investigation, and they had the House Select Committee on Assassinations and concluded it was a conspiracy. They fudged some things, but they came up with a lot of new evidence, and it's a disturbing case in the sense that so much of it was falsified for us, and you have to sort through all the different records and stories, and as people like Horn did, find witnesses in the Tippit case, too. Oswald didn't do that, and I found evidence that two policemen, or at least there was another police car on the scene, two men were involved in killing Officer Tippit, and half of the witnesses said it looked like Oswald and half said there were two men doing it, or some other version. And but a lot of the witnesses who said it was Oswald, there were a lot of problems with their stories, and they changed their stories, et cetera. And so there were many things about the case that if we had known them that weekend, it would have just changed our view of the world completely, because there was an Oswald impersonator going around, and there were two people being run by the CIA with the same identity, which sounds very bizarre and took me a long time to believe, but there's indisputable evidence that in the spy world, they often do that, have different people sharing identities for plausible denial and to confuse people, and that's what happened in that case.
How could such a massive conspiracy that you're implicating or implying here, how could such a massive conspiracy be kept secret for so long?
Well, you know, it wasn't. I mean, that day, frankly, I didn't believe it. I mean, I was only 16 and 17, actually. And, you know, the first thing, I ran to a radio when I heard he was shot, and from 1240 on, I was hearing that the radio was, the reports were saying shots came from the front, from the railroad bridge or the hill, what we now call the grassy knoll. And then at 1 o'clock, they started saying all the shots came from behind, and I registered that there was something funny, because when they start changing stories without explanation, I start doubting things. And so part of what I try to do if something terrible happens is get to a radio or a TV as fast as possible before they can change the story. And that evening when I saw Oswald saying, "I'm just a patsy," I believed him. And so by the end of the day, I wasn't believing. And then the Warren report came out, and I was persuaded, like a lot of people. I thought, okay, well, that makes sense. But, you know, I hadn't studied it carefully, and when other people started questioning it, I began paying more attention. So I think that a lot was known, and there was a lot of skepticism from the beginning. And there was a Gallup poll a week later after the shooting that I think it was 59% of the public thought two men were involved, or more than one person was involved. And consistently over the years, about 70 or so percent of the American public doesn't believe the lone gunman theory. But that's one reason we don't believe, you know, there's so much disbelief in government. When I was a kid, we all kind of believed what the government told us, but then we started being lied to, and the Vietnam War and Watergate came along, and it led to this terrible skepticism that goes on. But in a way, it's healthy, because we question things we're told, but then it's twisted into the president calling things fake news when people don't agree with him. But I think people have to be very critical consumers of the news. I teach that in my classes. You have to read as many sources as possible and study documents and read books, and don't read just one newspaper. Don't look at just one television show. You know, get your sort out the facts for yourself and be a critical observer.
Well, there are those who have studied this perhaps as closely as you, Vincent Bugliosi, Gerald Posner, and they came to a remarkably different conclusion, that Oswald definitively acted alone. Do you think they were writing their works in good faith?
Frankly, no, I don't. I think Posner definitely was. I mean, if you look at those books, they leave out so much, so many facts, and they twist a lot of facts. You know, you can find documents and you can find reliable witnesses and things to challenge most of their conclusions. And I have more respect for people who will examine all the evidence and then take a stand one way or the other. But in those cases, they just, you know, it's very artfully twisting reality to have a preordained conclusion. And Bugliosi has a lot of footnotes and things and documents that often contradict what he claims in his main argument. So I don't think those books are honest. Those are the pretty disgraceful books, frankly, I think. There are some really good books on the assassination.
Well,
Accessories After the Fact by Sylvia Meir is a great book about dissecting the Warren Report.
There are others, like Dan Moldea, who believes, like you, that there was a conspiracy, perhaps a massive one, but that it involved the mob. It didn't involve the U.S. government. How do you answer people who have that belief?
Well, I don't think the mob, the mob could not have run the military autopsy. They didn't have that power. The mob could not have created the Warren Commission, for example. The mob might have had some involvement. Jack Ruby was a mob-connected person who was sent in to kill Oswald. So they might have made use of the mob, like the CIA for a while was trying to use mobsters to kill Castro. But there's no way the mob could have pulled off the very complex and very powerful conspiracy that did take place. So I think people who try to blame the mob, it's kind of a way of dodging the fact that elements of the government did it. You know, and this, so that's the House Select Committee came down with the mob theory pretty much too. So I think it's simplistic.
Well, how could the Dallas Police Department, J.D. Tippit, the officer who was killed, be involved in this conspiracy as far as the government taking him out too, if your thesis is correct, Joseph?
Well, the Dallas police were very corrupt. Henry Wade, the DA, I interviewed him, who gave me a lot of interesting information, but it turned out later that he had convicted a lot of innocent people and sent them to to be executed or in prison, and the subsequent DA got a lot of them freed through DNA evidence that Wade had saved. And the police department was full of far-right extremists and even Ku Klux Klan members. I interviewed one of the police detectives who actually showed me his Klan membership card while we were talking. And Tippit was corrupted by, he was involved with a lot of right-wingers. He was working in a restaurant where there were a lot of right-wing people frequented that, and it would have been easy to recruit him for the plot, and he was a good gunman. But I think he was a patsy in a sense, too, that he was set up to be killed, partly because he might have known too much about certain things, but also they needed somebody to blame it on and get policemen to come into Oak Cliff, that area of Dallas where Oswald was captured. And when I interviewed Henry Wade and Jim Lavelle, who was the lead detective in the Tippit case, Lavelle basically told me that Captain Fritz that night said, "We don't really have a case for Oswald killing Kennedy, so make a case for him killing Tippit." And Wade admitted pretty much the same thing to me when I interviewed him, that the evidence really didn't hold up very well, and so they kind of manufactured a lot of stories. But the Tippit case was used psychologically, that you'd think, well, if he killed a policeman, he must have killed the president, which is not logical. You know, there could have been other reasons. But when you find out he didn't kill the policeman, too, the whole thing collapses.
Well, we enjoyed spending time with you, and certainly you've provided some provocative information, and as you always have about this, and as noted, this story continues to have legs 55 years later. It'll be interesting to see where it goes. Thank you, Joseph McBride, author of Into the Nightmare, My Search for the Killers of President John F. Kennedy and Officer J.D. Tippit.
Well, thanks a lot, Jim. It's always good to talk to you. Thanks for having me.